will build through the period. Highs over the weekend approaching 90 and in the low 90s for Monday and for Tuesday. Right now, 72. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is coming up. Welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Before we get to today's morning show, I wanted to convey a bit of important information. I've had a couple of people ask about the opera performances this weekend at the Rhodey Center for the Arts by the Kenosha Opera Festival, asking if it's possible to order tickets without the use of a computer. And I did receive information last night that tickets will be available at the door for these performances, both Friday night and Saturday night of The Daughter of the Regiment. And more information about that production is available if you go to WGTD's Morning Show Archive. Now, today's program. I count myself very, very privileged indeed to be able to spend the next few minutes with an award-winning investigative reporter for the Miami Herald, named Julie K. Brown. She is responsible for one of the most discussed books before the American public today, a book called Perversion of Justice, The Jeffrey Epstein Story. Jeffrey Epstein, as many of you perhaps know, was a billionaire who ended up being charged in 2008 with soliciting prostitution from a minor. It was actually a case of someone reaching out in the most inappropriate of ways to young girls, a plethora of them, perhaps hundreds of them. And what ultimately happened to Jeffrey Epstein was a plea bargain that shocked most of the public. And yet somehow that shock receded and not a lot of attention was paid to the details of that. It was years later when Julie K. Brown decided to investigate further. And the result of her groundbreaking investigative series for the Miami Herald actually led to a reopening of the case, the rearrest of Jeffrey Epstein, and the reincarceration of Jeffrey Epstein. And it is really a story that, as much as anything, underscores the essential role of journalism and investigative journalism, particularly when it comes to giving voice to those who have no voice in what is sometimes a sharply lopsided system of justice. It's an important story on so many levels, brilliantly told in this new book, again titled Perversion of Justice, The Jeffrey Epstein Story, published by Day Street, an imprint of William Morrow. Julie K. Brown, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks for having me.
And I'm going to say something that I have heard said time and time again on NPR's Fresh Air, and I know that's a program that you appeared on recently, and I so often have heard Terry Gross or Dave Davies or other guest hosts, when speaking to someone like yourself, they will say, you know, welcome to the Fresh Air, and thank you for your reporting. I don't think in all of the years that I have done my own program, I've ever thanked someone for their reporting. But after reading your book, that's one of the first things I felt like saying, thank you for your reporting. And I feel like a lot of people, when they read your book, will come away from it with a new understanding and appreciation, not just of what you did specifically in this case, but in general, the hard work of an investigative reporter, particularly for a story that is as important as this one. As you sought to write your book, Perversion of Justice, was that a conscious choice on your part to not only write specifically about Jeffrey Epstein and his victims and this miscarriage of justice, but were you also intentionally trying to tell the story of what investigative reporters do?
Well, one of the things that surprised me about the original series that I, of course, couldn't predict was the outpouring of support and thanks that I received from the general public about the journalism part of it, you know, the investigative work that I did. You know, journalists rarely get fan mail, and so it was kind of shocking to me that so many people were so appreciative of the work that I did. And remember, this was also happening at the time that journalists were being, you know, basically called the enemy of the people. You know, President Trump was almost daily slamming journalists. So when I began to write the book, I've often also thought that journalists don't do a good job of telling the public how we do and what we do. We just tell the story. We don't like to be part of the story. So I thought this might be an opportunity to explain to people a little bit about how, you know, just the, you know, just how we do what we do and why we do it, and the sacrifices and the struggles that we go through in getting a story like this. Hmm. So I guess there was a conscious decision at some point that I was going to include some of that in the book.
And I am so glad you do. And so I guess that would be one way in which the book, Perversion of Justice, is distinct from this series of articles that you did for the Miami Herald, that those in those you did not go out of your way to sort of explain your gauntlet as an investigative reporter, but in this book you do. Just to touch on one of a number of different aspects that you share with us about how challenging this was. There's a point in one chapter that's titled Dead Ends, in which you share a kind of a litany of frustrations that you are experiencing at that point in time. And at one point in the chapter, you describe what it's like to read through the depositions that were part of the original case against Jeffrey Epstein, these 2009 Epstein case. You write, each of them was more than 400 pages long and exhaustive. If you've never read a deposition, trust me, it is one of the most tedious court documents you could ever suffer through. I was beginning to understand why so many journalists had passed or had been dissuaded from doing more on the story. Can you just say, just for a moment, what these depositions are like and what it means for an investigative journalist like yourself to take the time to explore them and glean from them important information?
Well, the process of giving a deposition or taking a deposition is really an exercise on the part of the lawyer to, for a number of purposes, one, to find out what the person knows or doesn't know, but also there's sort of a, you know, a head game that, in the process involving wearing the person down and asking the same question perhaps 20 different ways.
Wow.
So you don't need to read that question again, asked another way over and over and over again. And in this particular case, the, you know, Epstein's lawyers, these were civil lawyers that Epstein hired, essentially to really try to bully some of these witnesses in the case. So to do that, they, you know, just kept pounding them with questions that just did, some of them didn't even have anything to do with the case itself. You know, they could ask them anything. So, you know, they go on and on and on. And then you might get one question where you say, oh, okay, finally, this is what I want to know. But you have to almost read the whole thing because the questions are, you know, interspersed. The ones you really need, you can't get to them unless you go through all the other questions.
Right. This is just probably one facet of all of this that helps explain something that you say very early in the book, namely that it's not that nothing had been written about Jeffrey Epstein or the outrage that had emerged over what he had done, or even some of the outrage over the plea deal that was ultimately struck, but despite the fact that a lot had been written by countless journalists, there was something sort of incomplete or maybe insubstantial about what had been written about the Jeffrey Epstein case until you came along. How would you, in general, characterize kind of the failing of earlier efforts to write about Jeffrey Epstein? What were they missing, and what were they sort of caught up in instead?
Well, I noticed, you know, having been a criminal justice reporter for so many years, one of the things that bothered me when I read a little bit of the reporting, I didn't read it all by any means because I kind of wanted to start from scratch and I didn't want to be influenced by what had been written. But in a cursory examination of what was coming up when I did a search, for example, it always seemed to be stories about celebrity, you know, these rich people and these famous people and, you know, his plane. And the focus was never really on the criminal justice system and how he got the deal and why he got the deal. It was just, oh, this is horrible that he got the deal, and he's this guy who hangs around with Trump and Clinton and, you know, all these other celebrities. Nobody really analyzed exactly how the whole thing happened and why. And I was just curious, like, how does something like that happen? And so I sort of looked at it like I compare it to being a cold case detective, pulling the box out and dusting everything off and just looking at every piece of paper. As I said, I covered a number of crimes. You know, I was covering, I used to be a police reporter. And I just know that when a detective takes it out, you have to look at every single little piece of paper because there might be something in there that you hadn't really seen before, or a piece of information that didn't make any sense back 10 years ago when the case was open, but maybe makes more sense now.
We're speaking with Julie K. Brown, and we're talking about her book, Perversion of Justice, The Jeffrey Epstein Story. This is a book that not only explores what Jeffrey Epstein did, which led to his arrest back in 2006, and ultimately a plea agreement that was reached, but then the process by which Julie K. Brown investigated the Jeffrey Epstein case and this plea agreement. And it was in a series of reports or articles for the Miami Herald that a whole new round of outrage was stirred up, and ultimately Jeffrey Epstein was rearrested. This case was reopened, and this book explores all of that in really extraordinary fashion. I want to be sure to give you a chance to talk about an intriguing thing you say in the chapter in which you focus on your work with the Miami Herald. At one point, you call the state of Florida the state of haves and have-nots. The haves are all those people who live in waterfront palaces, drive fast, expensive cars, break the law, and get VIP treatment everywhere they go. While they donate to charitable causes, they would rather not mix with those who benefit from that charity, the have-nots. That turn of phrase, the state of haves and have-nots, I think is important because that also, in a sense, is the story of who Jeffrey Epstein was and why he was able to get away with what he got away with for so many years. Tell us more about this sort of state of imbalance between the haves and have-nots in a state like Florida, and how you have seen that play out, and if the case of Jeffrey Epstein was just more of the same but just taken to a kind of an extraordinary degree.
Well, I think that this story epitomizes, in a way, not only Florida, but our nation's lopsided system of justice and how real broken it is in so many ways. In Florida, you know, we have, I believe it's the second or third largest prison population, for example, and in the country. And we had the largest women's prison in the country. And, you know, I did cover Florida prisons for a number of years, and I was just astonished at the number of people who were in prison for very long prison terms for minor drug crimes. And these were almost always people of color. They were women who committed crimes largely because they were economic crimes to support their families. It just, and yet, you know of people that do this who are have more financial means, and they're not serving. I mean, one of the victims in this case, for example, here in Florida, had a drug problem. She ended up serving 3 years in state prison for a drug crime. And here you have someone like Jeffrey Epstein, who served 18 months, most of it out of his office. He didn't really spend hardly any time behind bars. So think about that. You know, he molests, you know, at that time they knew at least almost three dozen girls. And here's a girl who has a drug problem and is struggling with trauma, and she ends up spending more time in prison than him.
Hmm. Let's talk about the circumstances in your life in which you made the choice to approach the Jeffrey Epstein story. Oddly enough, you tell us in the book that, in a sense, part of what led you to be in a place to undertake this was, in part at least, because of the possibility of getting a new job or a different job with the Washington Post, something which ultimately did not come to pass, and you are still with the Miami Herald. Just explain a little bit about what was going on in your life professionally and what relationship that has to you ultimately taking on this particular story.
Well, you know, journalism is a, you know, it's a tough career. It's very hard. The only way you can really make more money is to go to a larger paper. And so I was aiming to go to the Washington Post. I always really wanted to work either at the Philadelphia Inquirer, the Washington Post, or the New York Times. They were always sort of my goals. And at this particular time, I was in the running for a job at the Post, had a couple of interviews. They were going well. And I was sort of dragging my feet in entering another big project, because I thought if I leave, I don't want to be in the middle of a project. Ultimately, what happened was I didn't get the job, and I had been looking at this case, the Jeffrey Epstein case, and usually when I get a big disappointment in my life or in my career, I dig in and I work even harder. It's just one of the ways that I can get through a bad period. I just work harder. And basically what happened, I decided I'm going to dig into a new project because that'll take my mind off of the fact that I didn't get the job. Hmm. And this was the project.
It sprang out of another line of inquiry that you were following at the time. In other words, another story not completely unrelated, but not directly connected to the story of Jeffrey Epstein. Explain what you were exploring in the Florida criminal justice system at the time.
Well, I was covering Florida prisons, as I mentioned, and one of the things I knew from interviewing women in the women's prison, I knew that sex trafficking was a huge problem in Florida. Again, I felt like it was a subject that wasn't really being covered, and I started doing some research on it, and every time I, basically did a search on sex trafficking in Florida, inevitably a Jeffrey Epstein story would come up. So I would read it, and I'd think, wait a minute, how did this happen? And then I would, go back. I was doing other projects, working for a regional paper like the Herald. You don't have the luxury of just working on one thing. So other stories happened, and I, worked on them and then kept coming back to sex trafficking and, again, seeing another Jeffrey Epstein story until, around this time, President Trump was picking a new cabinet member, and he selected Alexander Acosta, who was the former Miami prosecutor who signed off on Epstein's lenient plea deal. So I expected that he would be grilled about that because it had been covered, yet he wasn't. It was almost as if everybody had forgotten about it. He really was just got a couple of questions on it. He answered it with his pat answers that he had always given that didn't make any sense. And that was the end of it. And he was confirmed. So at that point I decided I'm going to look at this case again. And the other part of it that I realized was the women, you know, who were teenagers when this happened had never really been interviewed. Their voices were like not in this any of the stories that I read. So I was also curious to see what they thought about Acosta being labor secretary, because this is an agency that oversees human trafficking and child labor laws. And so it has some oversight of issues that were related to this particular case. And so I set out to really initially just try to see if I could get any of them to talk to me.
Hmm. At this point, I think it'd be good for us to take a moment to talk about who Jeffrey Epstein was and how he gained such wealth and such incredible influence in the lives of all kinds of famous people.
Well, I think that Jeffrey Epstein was the kind of person that, you know, in some ways I think he was very phony. I think that he managed to make an awful lot of money, mainly by ingratiating himself into people's lives. He was very good at manipulating people and inserting himself in a way that made them feel like they could trust him. And in my opinion, I mean, nobody really knows exactly what the source of his wealth is, but I suspect that he was sort of a super-duper money launderer. So he was helping people, you know, basically hide their money, and he made a lot of money doing this. I mean, if you help a whole kingdom, so to speak, in Saudi Arabia, invest their money or hide it in some way, and you get a percentage of it, you earn an awful lot of money. And that's what I suspect he did. As I said, no one really knows for sure exactly how he made all that money. But in any event, he had a lot of money, so he could dangle that in front of people like researchers at Harvard who wanted money for their research. You know, some of these people were, you know, Nobel Prize-winning, you know, physicists, and, you know, there were, you know, famous lawyers like Alan Dershowitz. He moved in circles where he would meet, you know, actors and actresses and socialites. And, you know, he at one point met Ghislaine Maxwell, a British socialite whose father also died of mysterious circumstances, and had, you know, she began to introduce him around to a lot of famous people because she was very socially and politically connected to people like Bill Clinton, you know, and Trump, really. You know, that he met all those people and moved in those circles. He wasn't a real social butterfly. He preferred to have these sort of salons where he would have smaller kind of gatherings where they would talk about, you know, subjects like how to save the world, kind of, for lack of a better way of describing it, just social, political issues. And he fancied himself as this kind of person who was probably more intelligent than he really was, although I think he was more, his smarts were more in the way that he was able to manipulate people.
Right. And one of the ways he manipulated people and even entire institutions was through money. I mean,
right,
making philanthropic donations, not only to scientific ventures, but, for instance, to the local police department, which you tell us was probably, to some extent, quite deliberate and self-serving. You also at one point describe him as an eccentric bachelor, socially awkward, a germaphobe. And you know, those are aspects of him and his personality and characteristics that we don't tend to see or hear about too much.
Yeah, he never went out to dinner, for example. He had his chefs flown everywhere that he went. He was a very healthy eater. He, you know, did yoga. He meditated. Things like that, and he was a germaphobe. And, you know, there are stories that I heard about him, you know, having worn a shirt and taking it off and just throwing it away and picking another shirt. I mean, he had, you know, people that did almost everything for him. He didn't have to, you know, of course, do any cleaning or any of that kind of thing. So he was, you know, that's one of the reasons why I, you know, question some of the, you know, the authorities that say he committed suicide. It just doesn't fit his profile, considering he didn't do anything on his own. I mean, he had butlers that practically tied his shoes for him, and for him to be able to do something that would have been considered so, I mean, unclean, it just doesn't seem to fit his profile.
So, without spending too much time, I think it's important for us to recap what it is that got Jeffrey Epstein into such trouble in 2006. And it is especially important, as we learn about what he did with these many young women, to also understand the kind of young women that he had such rabid fascination in. Because that is a essential dynamic in this story and how it played out.
Well, remember, Jeffrey Epstein had plenty of money. So if he really wanted to exercise some kind of perversion, he could have hired the best prostitutes, the most beautiful prostitutes that he anywhere in the world. But he didn't want to pay for prostitutes. He wanted young girls, and he wanted girls that were almost virginal. This was his obsession was, you know, feeling in control, and even the aspect of that these girls, when they went in there, not knowing what really was going to happen to them, because the whole ruse was they were going there, you know, they were girls from, broken homes to some degree. Some of them were in foster care. A couple of them were homeless. You know, they weren't all in that category, but a great deal of them were. He preyed on those kind of girls because he felt that if anything went awry, that no one would believe them. You know, these were girls that no one probably would believe if they said that he had done this to them. And to some degree, he was right, because ultimately what happened was, first, the state prosecutor, you know, was, you know, at first gung-ho about prosecuting him. And as soon as Epstein's lawyers came and showed them these girls' Facebook pages, or at that time they were called MySpace pages, you know, and the girls were talking about teenage girl stuff, about, you know, smoking marijuana and, you know, having sex with boys and just, you know, things like that, the prosecutors changed their minds and said these girls aren't credible. And so ultimately, the kind of girls that he picked worked in his favor because the prosecutors felt they weren't credible.
You, in one of the interviews that you were ultimately able to do with one of these young women, someone named Courtney, she said to you, Jeffrey Epstein preyed on girls who were homeless and were addicted to drugs. He didn't victimize girls who were Olympic stars and Hollywood actresses. He victimized people he thought nobody would ever listen to, and he was right. Explain how ultimately Epstein did get into trouble, and who worked hard to bring his misdeeds to light and to lead to his arrest.
Well, I think most people have come to the conclusion that Jeffrey got pretty sloppy. He was just doing it too much. We suspect that he had some people that were advising him, maybe lawyer people who had legal experience, whether they were lawyers or not, or who knows, they could have been friends who were police officers. I think that he was advised to be really careful. Don't force yourself on them, and only do girls who are like, you know, 18, you know. And he just started getting them younger and younger and getting, you know, sloppy about it. And more and more forceful about it. You know, initially it was, okay, you don't want me to do this, that's fine, I don't have to do it. And then he would try again. I mean, the way that he did it was, you know, he didn't go and start grabbing them. He said, you're beautiful. He would groom them. He would tell them, you know, I can make your life better. I can pay for your college. I can get you into the Fashion Institute of Technology. Oh, I know the owner of Victoria's Secret. Why don't you model this underwear for me? I mean, he used all kinds of, you know, lines, so to speak, try to, you know, lure these girls into this situation where once they were in it, it was almost impossible to get out for some of them.
Right. And of course, one of the things you describe in the book is how, you know, a given young woman would find herself, you know, led into this room where this was going to happen with Jeffrey Epstein. And if she had wanted to leave, she wouldn't have known where to go. I mean, like, she wouldn't have known what doorways lead where to get her out of this mansion and ultimately out of this man's clutches. I mean, these women in some ways quite literally felt trapped once they had allowed themselves to be sort of lured into his lair, so to speak.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the other thing that was, there were a couple of people who recruited for him. One of them was, you know, according to what we know but based on her indictment, is Ghislaine Maxwell, who was his girlfriend at one point and became, according to authorities, became one of his top, really his main recruiter. And it is suspected that she started the whole pyramid scheme that he used to lure these girls, in that she would go out to spas in Palm Beach. She would give her business card to pretty girls that she ran into, you know, at the spas, health clubs, even schools. And she would say, you know, I have a very wealthy man. He's looking for an assistant, or, you know, he's looking for someone to do massage. You know, if it was a girl at a massage place, she would say he wants a personal masseuse. You'll be able to travel all over the world with him. He's got his private jet. Here's my business card. So then once they got a couple of girls to go from Palm Beach, and they got there and they realized, well, this isn't exactly what I thought it was, Epstein would say to them, well, look, if you don't want me to do this to you, you know, meaning continue to sexually assault you, all you have to do is bring me another girl. And for every girl you bring me, I'll give you the same amount of money, which was about $200 to $300 each. So then he had all these teenage girls in Palm Beach recruiting for him. And then those girls would be told the same thing, and so on and so on. So, you know, it was a way for them to also, you know, these girls all were sort of blamed each other in the end for what happened because they were recruited by another girl. So they were blaming the other girl. So the case became a very complicated one to investigate and prosecute.
Right. And one of the things you really spell out for us is the fact that many people involved in this case, including the prosecutors, really seem to reveal a profound misunderstanding of what childhood sexual abuse is all about. In other words, we're talking about these girls, these victims, that did not fit into the comfortable mold that the criminal justice system prefers. And that is one reason why this whole case was, in your mind, was approached the way it was.
Right. I talked to a number of experts in preparation for my interviews with the women, because I knew that they had been traumatized and I didn't want to re-traumatize them. So I did some homework before I interviewed them. And, you know, it was so good for me to do that because, you know, I didn't, and I think most people don't understand why some of these girls would have ever gone back after being molested one time. And, you know, why you know, they exactly what they went through in their head, you know, what that involves, you know, and how that changes you. I mean, one of the victims I interviewed only went one time, but it affected her the rest of her life. And so it was interesting to learn from some of the experts exactly what children and young people go through when they're sexually abused, what goes through their head and how it affects their lives.
So ultimately, your book circles around the plea agreement that was reached in this case. I mean, once Jeffrey Epstein has been arrested and charges brought against him, and of course, even the charges brought against him right at the outset are probably more limited than they should have been. But what is truly outrageous is the plea agreement that was reached and that was also sealed, at least for the most part. Help us understand the nature of this plea agreement and to what extent it was sealed in terms of its details.
Well, they made this deal, and you know, when we were able to really get our hands on all the documents, especially the communications that were going back and forth between Epstein's lawyers and the federal prosecutors, you could see how, you know, it was almost, to me anyway, it was too chummy, you know, for a guy who had molested all these girls, for the prosecutors to be so chummy with Epstein's attorneys really struck me as inappropriate. You know, Alex Acosta, the head, you know, the Miami U.S. attorney in charge of that office, for example, had breakfast with one of Epstein's top attorneys, just the two of them up in Palm Beach when this case was going on. And, you know, I thought it was strange. I guess I didn't realize how strange it was. It was other lawyers who, you know, I spoke with about it who said, oh, my gosh, that's just so wrong. You know, you just don't do that if you're a prosecutor. You don't have coffee one-on-one with one of the attorneys. It's just bad. And I think that, you know, that there was just, you know, these were a lot of them white men who were, you know, had known each other through legal channels. Epstein was another masterful move by him was hiring lawyers that had, you know, other personal or professional relationships directly with some of the prosecutors in the case. Hmm. You know, one of them, for example, one of his lawyers had dated the head of the criminal division in the West Palm Beach office who was on the case. Hmm. So he hired his former girlfriend as a lawyer. Hmm. I mean, that's what he did.
I think this is an example of what at one point you describe as the incestuous nature of Palm Beach's political and social ecosystem. I mean, that there were so many people with so many connections and people who should have been operating, in a sense, very distinctly from one another were, in a sense, just too chummy. And then when you stir in the added influence of Mr. Epstein's enormous wealth, to say nothing of also all that he knew about all kinds of influential people, it's just sort of a perfect recipe for a shocking miscarriage of justice. So when you decide to reopen this story, I mean, to unlock just what Jeffrey Epstein did and the nature of this plea agreement, one of the things you have to do is connect with the women who were his victims. But in many cases, in nearly every case, you don't even have their names to go on, nor anything else. Explain the challenge that you faced in terms of just identifying these women and then reaching out to them. It turns out that social media played a indispensable role in making this happen.
Right. You know, they were all minors when this happened, so their names were all essentially blacked out of all the documents that I obtained. But having done this, you know, before, I also knew that inevitably they forget to redact a name here or there. So that was another, you know, reason that I had to read every single document that was in the file, because that's how I found a name here or there, or I would find a first name without a last name, but maybe a date of birth, you know, and if I was able to get on a couple of the women's names who I did get. If I went on their social media pages and looked at their friends, there were other girls who were at that same age who looked similar. Epstein had this preferred type, which was usually very petite, blonde hair, blue eyes. So if you had one girl who you knew was a victim, you went on her page and she had two other girls who were blonde and blue-eyed, the chances of them being a victim, too, was pretty great. And I did manage to painstakingly track, put together a list of 60 names. It just took a long time.
You ultimately, after trying to make a few connections kind of in more of the pick up the phone or knocking on the door way, you ultimately send them a letter. And explain why you thought that was perhaps the best way to reach out and get a meaningful reaction, a response.
Well, I had called a couple of them, and, you know, you hear a person you don't even know on the other end of the phone bringing up something that you've never spoken to anybody about before. You know, some of these women never told anybody that this had happened to them. You're just going to hang up the phone without even listening. I tried things like, don't hang up. Just listen to what I have to say. You don't have to say anything. That makes them even more scared, you know. So I had to figure out a way to explain to them that I wanted to do something that I felt hadn't been done before. And the best way to do that, I felt, was to compose a letter to explain that to them. And basically, that's what I did. I said, you know, that I looked at this case. I'm still stunned by what happened. But one thing that I see that is missing is how did this deal happen? And I want to analyze how it did. And I noticed also that the one thing that this story is missing is your voice. You've never spoken about this. And I had a couple of responses. The only one that was willing to go on the record, I had a couple, four women ultimately went on the record. But from the letter, only one woman called me and went on the record, and that was Michelle Licata. She lived in Tennessee by this time. And even when we were on our way to Tennessee to interview her, we weren't sure she was going to go through with it because her lawyer had told her not to do that. And ultimately she did, and ironically, you know, a year later or so, I heard from her lawyer, and he said, I'm so glad Michelle didn't pay him any attention to me and that she told you her story. Hmm. So,
At one point in the book, you say that something to the effect that the single hardest thing for you in all of these conversations that you ultimately had with these young women was the shame that so many of them continued to harbor about what they had done or what they had experienced. Can you tell us more about that?
I just would get choked up every time they spoke about it in a way that they were angry with themselves. It just hurt me to the core to see that because they were so raw, you know. It was just like it had happened the day before, you know. The feeling that they had gone through, you could see it in their faces, in their body language, in their voices. The pain, you know, started spilling out of them in many of my interviews. And, you know, it's just hard. It's like watching a child that is hurt. You know, it just grabs at your heart, you know, to see something like that, knowing that these were girls who were, you know, 13, 14, and 15, who, some of whom, by the way, were very good students, you know, trying to, despite their, you know, struggles at home, still trying to be, you know, to get ahead, you know, to with dreams of going to college, you know, and things like that. And this kind of, for many of them, just devastated them.
You ultimately craft this series of articles for the Miami Herald that sort of blow the lid right off of this case, of course, inspiring a whole new round of renewed outrage. I mean, and probably outrage that had not yet been experienced in terms of the Jeffrey Epstein story. What do you think made the difference in terms of this series of articles having the impact that it did when so much else had already been written about Jeffrey Epstein?
Well, number one, we had very, very, very powerful documentaries that went with the series, and these were the girls talking about what they went through. We had photographs of them, what they looked like back then, you know, wearing braces, you know, to really show this is what this girl looked like that was abused, you know. We had also had, which, you know, I don't think that the two officers, the police chief and the lead detective who participated and cooperated with us, had never spoken publicly before. And they were extremely important to this story. And the fact that they said they were trying so hard and to you know, put him away, and that all the prosecutors were doing was throwing up roadblocks at the same time that Epstein was trying to, you know, thwart them by following them, going through their trash, disparaging them in public. You know, one of his lawyers, you know, called the police chief crazy, basically, in public. You know, he's anti-Semitic. That's why he's going after him. He had a bad divorce. I mean, they were, you know, it was a scorched earth campaign to discredit these two officers who were the only people who had fought for these girls since the very beginning. Nobody else really did at all.
Hmm. Were you fearful of suffering the same sort of thing as being part of that, a target of that same scorched earth approach?
Well, I knew that there was a very good chance that they were going to do that, and I spoke with the executive editor about this project pretty early on to warn her that this was could ultimately be a real tough case, because, you know, these are people who are very litigious, willing to sue us, you know, at any turn. So I was well aware that possibility was there. Plus, the police chief kept telling me, you know, I'm telling you, you're never going to be able to publish a story because somebody's going to call your publisher and tell them something that's going to turn, you know, because other reporters, he knew of other journalists who had tried to do this story before and couldn't get it done. So he was skeptical that we were going to ever do it. But, you know, I think as I got deeper and deeper into it, I realized that there was so much material that was public that I could use. I didn't use any anonymous sources on this story. Everything that was in it, because I knew it was going to be lawyered by not only our lawyers, but, you know, Epstein's lawyers, and they were going to try to find anything to poke a hole in it. And So everything that I had in that story was either from my own original reporting or from the records. I didn't use any of the previous reporting. I just totally, you know, did it from, you know, took it apart from the very beginning and put it back together in a way I think that no one had been able to do before.
Right. I mean, an immense amount of work. And, of course, it paid off handsomely in terms of this case being reopened, Jeffrey Epstein, ultimately being sent back to jail where he dies under mysterious circumstances. In our last minute or so, what remains in terms of continuing to pursue full justice for those who were part of this? I mean, are there, in a sense, legal loose ends that await tying up?
Well, they have to put together a pretty solid case against Ghislaine Maxwell, who now is indicted on sex trafficking charges in New York. You know, but there were other people that helped Epstein besides Maxwell. And, you know, I think that the victims, for one, really believe that the authorities need to dig a little deeper and to start looking at other people in that circle besides Maxwell. And so we'll have to wait and see how you know, if they do that and you know, if other people will be indicted.
Hmm. Well, as I said at the outset, your book is an extraordinary demonstration of the importance of investigative journalism and particularly when it comes to the kind of investigative journalism which gives voice to people who are, in so many respects, voiceless. And you've done that in such impressive fashion. The book is Perversion of Justice, The Jeffrey Epstein Story, published by Day Street, an imprint of William Morrow, the author, Julie K. Brown. And her series of articles for the Miami Herald secured for her a shelf full of much-deserved awards.